First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
In this election season, local officials under pressure to redraw Duval's lines of political power. Good morning. We're live from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we've got the latest on the city's ongoing redistricting mess. As early voting is already underway, give us a call with your questions. It's 549-2937. Then later, don't miss our ticket giveaway to the Jacksonville Fair. That and much more coming up this hour. But first this morning, the Jacksonville City Council will not attempt to comply with the Voting Rights Act in its proposed district maps. This is the latest in the saga over redistricting in the city. Now, you may recall a federal judge ordered officials to redraw the maps, ruling that they were likely gerrymandered to dilute Black voting power in the city. At the same time, neighborhoods are expressing concern that their historic neighborhood districts could be broken up. There's so much to discuss. Journalist Andrew Pantazzi has been covering the story at the Jax Tributary, and he joins us now in studio with an update. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you. Lots of questions about this. What are your questions about the federal lawsuit that has forced the city council to redraw district maps and their pushback to this? Give us a call, 549-2937, 549-2937, emails to firstcoastconnect at wjct.org. Tweets to at Melissa in Jax. So, Andrew, you've been covering this from the beginning. What's the latest?
So the latest, as you said, is they've finally gotten maps, and these draft maps drawn by an expert, when they got them, the top lawyer for the city, the general counsel, made clear that the city has not done any analysis in order to see if the maps comply with the Voting Rights Act, and they don't intend to do so in the future either. So they will... they plan to pass a map tomorrow at 9 a.m., and they won't know if that map violates the Voting Rights Act. And just for background for, you know, listeners who are tuning in, the lawsuit came in alleging not a Voting Rights Act violation, but alleging a 14th Amendment violation. But that doesn't mean they can now violate the Voting Rights Act and get away with it if they pass a new map, because the court may still consider, and the court has said she plans to consider, whether whatever new map gets passed by the city council is complying with the Voting Rights Act. So if they pass something that does violate it and plaintiffs can show that it violates it, it's possible the court ends up ruling again against the city and using a different map for the city council and school board.
Wow. Okay, so what are some of the city council members saying? For example, the plaintiffs in this case drew their own map. They called it a unity map that they said would be more fair. The city council doesn't want that map.
Yeah, there was very little discussion of the plaintiff's map. There was one council member, Councilman Roy Diamond, said that it seemed like it was a pro-democratic gerrymander. I will say partisan metrics show all of the proposals to be pro-Republican. It is the least pro-Republican of the proposals. But other than him, there hasn't been much said about the plaintiff's map. It's mostly been focused on what the city expert produced, and they honed in on two maps, and one in particular, which they're calling the maroon map. And that maroon map, as
the maroon map, okay.
Yeah, so he named all of his maps after colors, and the maroon map, as you noted earlier, sparked a lot of outrage for what it did to neighborhoods. The city has all along claimed that there's no neighborhoods map that exists. It's a very bizarre claim. I created an interactive map from a city shapefile of neighborhood designations that I got from the city, but the city has claimed they don't know where that file came from. They've said no file exists, and they don't have any definitions of neighborhood. So when Councilwoman Randy DeFore, who came on your program last week, said she wants Riverside and Avondale and Murray Hill to be kept together, the city said, we don't have definitions of those neighborhoods. We don't know what they are, which a lot of neighbors in the area called them out on. What was essentially a lie. I mean, there is a zoning overlay. There are definitions of the historic district.
549-2937. Yes, last Friday, City Council Member Randy DeFore appeared right here in this studio. And this is what she had to say about the process.
You know, it's very complicated. It's a very complicated process. I was on the redistricting committee. We relied heavily on history on the past. And because of that, we didn't really move the lines that much. I think we found that, obviously, that based on this order, that we couldn't do that. If you look at the order, I don't know if you've read the order, it really goes back in history and talks about past councils, not our council, past council, to ultimately come to the conclusion that it needed to be redone. And in terms of the unity map, I think it's a partisan map. And I think what we
why do you say that?
Because just as we talked about, it increases the representation probably from the Democrats. And if you look at my district, based on that new map, if we were to go with that, splits up Murray Hill, Riverside, Avondale, and Ortega. That, you know, we are historically have all been together. And I don't think if you split those areas up, what ultimately happens is I don't think they're going to get the representation that they deserve.
Okay, that was Randy DeFore. So a couple of things are going on here, it seems. Randu, concerns that the maps dilute Black voting power in the city, which of course is what sparked the federal lawsuit, but also concerns that any new maps that are drawn will split up historic neighborhoods.
Yes, that's absolutely right. So the map, again, they didn't provide any analysis to say how Black voters would be able to elect their preferred candidates under the new map. They said they weren't able to do that analysis. Even at one point, Council President Terrence Freeman asked the analyst if it's true that the map would go from 4 to 3 minority access districts. And the expert replied saying, I'm not going to use that term minority access. That's a legal term that requires analysis. I haven't done that. And then separately, as you said, there's the neighborhoods, which Riverside, Avondale, Murray Hill, Ortega, they've been very vocal. But there's also other neighborhoods that have been vocal, including District 9 gets drawn in a very uncompact way. It's already very not compact, but Councilwoman Tyrona Clark-Murray has complained about what it does to some of the neighborhoods that would be broken up with her district. And again, the response has been both that they don't have a neighborhoods map, but also, bizarrely, yesterday, the general counsel said they don't need to worry about whether a district is compact. The reason that's so bizarre is the city charter, which acts like a constitution for the city of Jacksonville, explicitly says that the districts must be logical and compact. But not only that, they must be as logical and compact as is possible. Mm. And Jason Teal, the general counsel, is essentially saying, don't worry about the charter. Don't worry about following our local laws. Even at a time where, connected to this lawsuit, when it goes to a full trial, they're suing over the city charter compactness claims. They're claiming you didn't draw compact districts. And Jason Teal is saying, don't worry, I agree. They're odd shaped. They're funny looking. They're not compact. But I don't think you need to worry about following city law.
The city's chief attorney saying we don't need to follow the law is what you're saying.
The city's chief attorney, he didn't cite the charter, but he obviously knows the charter better than anyone. He knows it requires compact districts. And he's saying you do not need compact districts. Don't worry about whether they are compact or not.
As you report, and I'm quoting from your piece, the proposed maroon map, that's the one the council wants, was the least compact of the four proposed maps and had the most pro-Republican bias. And it also split many neighborhoods, not popular among white or Black voters. You report the plaintiff's map, the so-called unity map they drew themselves, was the most compact, had the most neutral partisan bias, and split the least number of neighborhoods. You're saying this unity map had the most neutral partisan bias, but multiple members of the city council say it has a Democratic bias.
Yeah, they're comparing it to the current map, which is very pro-Republican. So if in a 50-50 city, where our vote tends to be 50-50 split between Republicans and Democrats, you have a map that will likely have, out of 14 districts, regularly 8 or 9 Republicans winning versus 10 or 11 Republicans winning. They see that and they say that's a Democratic gerrymander. When in reality, the partisan metrics, there's these mathematical equations you can run. Every single one of them shows that the plaintiff's map still has a pro-Republican bias. Part of that is due to residential segregation in our city, but it's still where it leans is a little bit slightly to Republicans, yet the council members see it and they say, no, that's a Democratic gerrymander because it's more pro-Democratic than the current extreme, both racial and partisan gerrymander that we have in the city.
Let's go to your calls now. Our guest in studio today is Andrew Pantazzi at the JAX Tributary. He's been doing really detailed reporting on the city's redistricting mess, which has sparked a federal lawsuit and a federal judge ordering our local officials to do it over. But how is that going to end? How will this story end? We'll get to that in a minute. But first, let's go to your calls. 549-2937. Joseph in Riverside. Hi, Joseph. Good morning. Go ahead.
Morning. I would just like to talk about Randy DeFore's comments. It's a little troubling to hear a city council person refer to history as the basis to draw these district maps, because as we know, historically, cities in the South have done anything they can to repress the minority vote, and we're seeing laws passed both at the state and local levels that will effectively repress voting in general and voting of minorities. So I'd like to see perhaps maps that aren't based on history and are based on third-party objective analysis. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, of course, a number of states and communities around the country have taken the redistricting pen out of the hands of officials and given it to independent commissions. We can talk about that. But before we do, Andrew, what about his other comment?
Yeah, so the history has been very important to this case. Jacksonville has never had its redistricting plans challenged in court. This is the first time. So we've never had a legal ruling. And this legal ruling was very important in saying we've been doing it based on race for a long time. I did a really in-depth reporting going through old Florida Times Union archives and old city hall records, which showed how 1981, we started using what the Department of Justice would later call misinformation behind our redistricting, which is we thought we needed a 65% quota for certain districts where they had to be 65% black or higher. That continued in 1991 with what they called the 63% plan, where they slightly reduced it. And it continued in 2000 and in 2011. And then in 2021, when they were tasked with redistricting, they said, let's just continue using the map that we had before. And part of what the judge found is they didn't make that decision out of nowhere, but that decision was partly motivated by race. Mm. That they were saying, these maps already are doing what we want them to do racially, therefore let's keep them. And without ever doing an analysis to say, are those numbers appropriate? So the districts that passed from the city council ranged from 61% black to 70% black in four districts, which means about 55%, more than half of black residents in our city are in four out of 14 districts. Mm-hmm. And the main issue there is the surrounding districts around it. Black voters have very little to no influence in those districts. And if you had unpacked them, made them more close to where they should be, and made them more compact, that they would have more of an influence in the surrounding districts.
Don't they call it packing and bleaching? In other words, you pack African-American voters into a few districts, then you bleach a lot of other districts with white voters.
Absolutely. And the other element here, which has been around for decades, 1991, neighborhood activists in black majority neighborhoods, 2001, 2011, and again this time, is you had neighborhood activists who said beyond the racial impact, there's also an impact to their neighborhoods with the way these neighborhoods get sliced and diced. When you have Grand Park split up into three districts, or you have Sherwood Forest split into two districts, you have all these historic black communities that don't have a single representative. Mm-hmm. And they talk about how if you have a neighborhood association meeting and you've got three city council members, you have to publicly notice it, because city council members can't come to your meeting since they would be doing city business out of the sunshine.
Well, and theoretically, the at-large council members are supposed to fill that gap, right?
And many of them, I mean, this is where there's been some interesting interplay. I talked to one plaintiff just 2 days ago who was praising Councilman Matt Carlucci and saying, look, he's white, he's a Republican, and he's been more responsive to our community than our council member. And this woman said she's Democratic, she votes Democratic, but she likes him even more. And that this issue is not about Democrats and Republicans, but that in her mind, this issue was about protecting black neighborhoods in Jacksonville. And that was why they filed suit.
Whatever neighborhood you're in, give us a call, 549-2937. Mandy tweets the show, there should never be an instance where our historic districts are separated, as there are historic overlays that are specific to them. Having one council member to represent those districts is important rather than splitting between three of them. So people that live in these neighborhoods, they do care a lot about this, just as much as the plaintiffs who've sued over the racial gerrymander care about their voice.
Yeah, what's really interesting is that before the maps were given to the city council, just about the only city council member to be very explicit and specific in what she wanted in the maps was Councilwoman DeFore, who, as you heard on Friday before the maps came out, one of the things she had said is she wants to see Riverside, Avondale, and Murray Hill and Ortega kept together. Mm-hmm. And despite that being basically one of the only pieces of public guidance, the expert then said, we're going to take Riverside, Avondale, and Murray Hill, and we're going to split them into three different districts. Which is just really, I mean, it's suspicious why they would do something
and
like
that.
And
what would be the reason?
One of the things that the court has chided the past city council for in its redistricting process was that hundreds of people spoke out and they didn't make a single change in response to public opinion. It's possible they made something that's easy to fix so they can now go to the court and say, look, we listened to the people. Or it's possible that there's some interplay of just, you know, some punishing that like they're trying to have toward a community of that's mostly white Democratic. And so you have Riverside, Avondale, Murray Hill, where it's mostly white, but still Democratic. And maybe there's a little bit of we're going to show you that if we have to draw a map that unpacks black districts, then we're going to try to almost like turn a coalition of Democrats who've supported one another, white Democrats and black Democrats, and say, like, we're going to punish you for that by messing with your neighborhood. Who knows? But there's nothing, you can't look at this map and say, you drew these with neighborhoods in mind, you drew these to be compact, you drew these to be fair. It's very clear that when they were drawing these districts, especially in that area, that there was something other than compactness, something other than honoring neighborhoods that was in play.
All right. Julie tweets us, in addition to its anti-Semitism scandal, she's talking about the anti-Semitic hate messages that appeared all over town last week. Jacksonville makes news today for its redistricting plan that intentionally weakens black voter strength as we are already voting. The council is dragging its feet, responding to a federal court ruling saying it won't abide by the Voting Rights Act. This is nullification. That's a loaded term for people that know their history. Jurisdictions did it all over the South in the Civil War era. Public officials flout the law, do what they want, and too often get away with it. The rule of law depends on the most people complying. We are in so much danger right now. Okay, so Andrew, she's tying this redistricting fight in Jacksonville to what's happening at large all over America. And she even references nullification, which amounted to Southern states, you know, thumbing their nose at the federal government, saying they wouldn't comply with laws, not just the slavery matter, but other laws, other issues. In your view, as someone who's covered this so extensively, is this nullification? Is that what the city council is doing? Are they flouting the law? Are they flouting the will of the people?
I don't know if I'd go that far yet until they've passed a map. I do think that at minimum, it is remarkable in a very negative way that reflects poorly on city officials that despite the fact that since a legal memo came out in February of 2021, a year and a half ago, which said if they wanted to make race-based decisions in districts, they needed to do a VRA analysis. And then in February of this year, plaintiffs, before they had even filed suit trying to persuade city council not to pass a racially gerrymandered map, said, we will share with you our data, our code, and our analysis from our expert report, or else we'll sue. And then after they sued, they continued to offer to share data and analysis. And the city has rejected those offers. And now the city, on the verge of a deadline, says, we're sorry, it's too late, we can't do our job. Mm-hmm. I don't know of anybody in the private sector who can just say, I'm sorry, I decided I didn't feel like doing my job. I'll keep collecting my paycheck though. But that's essentially what the city is saying right now. And when it comes to nullification, we don't even have to look at states. We can look at Jacksonville's own history. You know, in the 1880s, a black coalition won elected office on city council. The white supremacist governor from Duval County, Francis Fleming, ends home rule and takes them out of office. In the 1940s, a black man almost wins city council, so they move from single-member districts to at-large elections so that he can't win. In the 1960s, black voters are about to become a majority and win all of the at-large seats, so we switch from at-large to single-member districts. And then, during consolidation, we promised there would be no at-large seats on city council, but the legislature changed it to ensure there were at-large seats in addition to the districts. Throughout Jacksonville's history, we've seen attempts to minimize black voting power. And I think that whether it was intentional or not, and I have a lot of reason to believe that it was not intentional. The 1980s, 1990s, 2000s, this was often led by council members who I think thought they were doing the right thing. They thought they were complying, but there was incompetence. There was not from city government an actual understanding of what the Voting Rights Act requires. Now that a court has told them they've done something illegal, rather than have the humility to say, maybe we messed up and we need to learn from this, what they've just been saying is, like, we're going to drag our feet and we're going to not do a Voting Rights Act analysis. We're not going to try to settle with plaintiffs. We're not even going to ask to look at the plaintiff's data that they've offered for us. We're going to just, with blindfolds on, pass a map and hope for the best.
Another tweet, it's amazing how blatantly our officials are defying the law and the judge. A partisan and racial gerrymander supported by folks protecting their own incumbency over constituents. This is shameful. Here's an email from a listener pushing back. He says, if black voters will not get blacks elected without race being a major factor, how do you explain that Duval has elected countywide officials who are black, like sheriff and mayor? Duval County will have a black sheriff, and the candidates defeated white candidates in the party primaries. So pointing out that we have a sheriff's election coming up, both candidates are African-American. Whoever wins, we will have an African-American countywide elected official running this massively important agency, JSO.
Yeah, so the issue is not the race of the candidate. The Voting Rights Act does not protect candidates. It's not the Candidates' Rights Act. It's supposed to be protecting voters. And so the issue is you're supposed to do an analysis that says, first, can you draw districts that are majority black, that are compact? You can. And second, do black voters vote cohesively for certain candidates? They do. And do white voters vote cohesively for opposing candidates? And then do the black supported candidates regularly lose? And in Jacksonville, yes. The fact that you can list on one hand the candidates who've won says something. And in this sheriff's race, what we saw is all candidates are black. That doesn't mean all candidates have the same level of support from black voters. And so we've seen this at the city council level as well, where there have been at-large. There's two right now at-large black Republicans. Sam Newby was initially elected, ran against Jacoby Pittman. And according to the plaintiff's analysis by their expert at the University of Texas, he received about 1% of the black vote. Terrence Freeman did better, but he still received a slim percentage of the black vote. And so that does not actually protect black voters if they're not able to elect their preferred candidates. And it also doesn't protect them if you're using race in a way that packs black voters in so much that you don't respect their neighborhood lines.
Jack tweets the show, the city's new appeal should trouble us as they are now seeking to tear apart the Voting Rights Act through the same insidious legal arguments made in Merrill versus Milligan. That is a pending case before the United States Supreme Court that deals with the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Okay, Susan in Mandarin. Hi, Susan. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I confess that I was not paying attention to redistricting when the state did it until I went to vote. And I found out that my state house district, District 12, has been split into two. And now instead of just my neighbors and I sharing the same representative, we're sharing it with people on the other side of the Buckman Bridge. I'm very active in Indivisible Mandarin. And we will go and do things in our neighborhood. And it because it was our district, District 12, and now they're on the other side of the Buckman Bridge. So how do I complain now? What do I do? I should have been paying attention earlier on, but now that I didn't, what can I do now? I want my district on this side of the Buckman Bridge for State House. And now I have Wyman Duggan as my representative, who I never voted for.
Well, I can't do anything about that. I mean, we don't always get our preferred candidates, even if we vote for them, Susan. But what about her other point?
Well, I think it's a point that's well taken. So the House district she's referring to, Wyman-Duggan, used to be the West Side, Riverside, Ortega, yeah. Avondale area. And now it crosses the Buckman and it's, you know, the like NAS Jax, Riverside, and it goes into Mandarin. And there was no complaints about it in real time. Mm-hmm. And not only that, the state House map after it passed, it received no challenge to the Florida Supreme Court. There's an automatic review and nobody filed an amicus or a brief to the Florida Supreme Court complaining. So there was nobody who really had a legal complaint with the way the legislature handled the state House districts. And so now those are the districts, unless the legislature voluntarily decides they want to rip up the map, which I don't think is.
You know, I have to say, given the impressive list you just gave our listeners through the decades of all of the various ways Black voting power has been diluted in this city, either deliberately or accidentally, it really is kind of amazing nobody's sued in this manner before now.
Yeah, it really is. Going through the archives at the TU, it was like every decade someone would threaten to sue, but then never follow through. They would complain, but then for whatever reason, I don't know why, many of the people have since passed, why they never sued. But it was, you know, just this constant threat, and there was never taking it seriously by the city. You know, it was really remarkable, especially 10 years ago, how many people were citing the law, saying the Department of Justice says you're supposed to do it like this. The VRA says this. You're misinterpreting the law. And city council was just scoffing at them. There was almost an open mocking of the residents because they're saying, no, we're going to do it the way we've always done it. So 2011, they did it the way they always did it. And then that repeated in 2021 when hundreds of people came out to public hearings and complained. And the city council said, we feel really confident. We're glad with our map and we're going to keep doing it. And I don't think we can look at how city council is acting now and think that they've learned any lessons from this.
They're going to vote on a new map. As you are saying, it may also get thrown out. So what can we expect next?
So they will, they plan to approve a new map on Friday. They have a meeting at 9 a.m. Their deadline is to have a map done by Tuesday of next week. So presumably they'll be done before the deadline. And then the plaintiffs will have time to challenge the map if they want to. And the plaintiffs can then submit their own maps. The judge will review the maps. And the deadline that has been set is that she needs to have new maps in place for the city by December 16th mm-hmm. by the supervisor's office. That's what they've said. So presumably she will by then. It's possible she chooses the city's maps or doesn't. She'll probably, I assume, give a lot of deference to the city. The city is the official elected body to handle redistricting.
And of course, that begs the bigger question. Should city officials be in charge of drawing their own lines? Should an independent body be doing this?
A lot of other places use independent panels. You know, Tampa, Orlando, Pinellas. There's a lot of other places in Florida, and then also across the country. Austin, Texas, has a really intricate way of selecting independent panels by almost a lottery process. And I think in other places with independent panels, there's been more trust in their redistricting process. We did a poll, the Tributary did, with UNF that found 89% of people, this was in February of this year before the court order, 89% of people said they did not trust city council to handle their own redistricting.
Of course, getting an independent commission would be no easy feat, but we'll have to leave that discussion for another day. Andrew Pantazzi of the Jax Trib, thank you.
Thank you.
And much more still ahead later. Don't miss our ticket giveaway. We've got another one today, this one to the Jacksonville Fair. But up next.
When I went to work at the Episcopal Church of Our Savior, I had no idea she'd ever lived here.
A local composer honors Civil War author Harriet Beecher Stowe, who had a home in Mandarin, with a new work of music. That's next.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back. The first of three planned Harriet Beecher Stowe works will premiere in the city this weekend. Now, this is Stowe's poetry, conceived as a requiem for the millions of American souls lost to COVID. Stowe, who authored Uncle Tom's Cabin, the explosive novel that helped turn Americans against the evils of slavery, actually once made her winter home in Mandarin, and she even helped found a church in the area that is still thriving today. Jacksonville composer Bob Moore has created this special event, and he gave me a preview. Hey, Bob, good to be with you as we talk about the legacy of Harriet Beecher Stowe. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Melissa.
Now, of course, Stowe was famous for penning the novel Uncle Tom's Cabin, which helped over time to bring about the end of slavery, helped spark the Civil War. People might not realize that she made her winter home here in Mandarin and even founded a church here. So how are you carrying on with her legacy this month?
Well, I'm premiering one of the first of three projects, musical projects, that I've conceived to celebrate her legacy, because I feel like it's, you know, somewhat obscure at this day and time. You know, someone that famous actually lived in the Jacksonville area. The people in Mandarin will say that she lived in Mandarin, but of course that's all Jacksonville now.
Mm-hmm.
But and when I went to work at the Episcopal Church of Our Savior, I had no idea she'd ever lived here. So this first of the three pieces that I'm going to write to celebrate her is called The Other World, A Requiem. Of course, a requiem comes from the Latin Roman Catholic Mass for the Dead. And this is all based on Harriet's poetry, because she wrote a lot of things besides Uncle Tom's Cabin, including a lot of religious poetry that was often focused on death and eternal life, because early in her life, she lost an infant son to cholera, which, of course, was a great pandemic of the time. So I've written this as a way to acknowledge Harriet and draw upon her experience, and also to acknowledge, you know, the great loss that we've had over the last couple of years through the pandemic. So it's kind of a synergy that's, you know, her presence in our community, the her loss of in her life, and then, you know, what we've been through.
Yeah. Her faith drove her opposition to slavery, the evils of slavery. And as you mentioned, she founded a church in the Mandarin area that's still thriving today. Will you be bringing this congregation into this production? Tell us more about it.
Well, it's going to be performed by two young soloists who used to work for me at the Church of Our Savior. They were UNF graduates, Jacob Rothman and Shelby Bonnet, really wonderful singers. They've gone on to graduate school, and they're going to come back and sing for us. The rest of the ensemble draws from the Florida Chamber Music Project and a couple of great percussionists in the area, Tony Steve and Charlotte Mavery, which a lot of people know, and Brandon Smith, a fellow church musician in the area. The congregation is sponsoring this and paying for it, but it's all kind of a performance for them on their behalf for the community.
Now, this is a way for people to, as you said, honor those who've died in the COVID pandemic, but also honor the legacy of Harriet Beecher Stowe. And I think you're right. Some people know that she had a presence here in our area, but it's not one of the famous names people most associate with Jacksonville. And if you go back to the pre-Civil War era, try to picture the most famous writer you can possibly imagine of today, you know, someone like mm-hmm. Stephen King or someone like that. That's how big a deal she was, and that's how influential her book was.
Yeah, she was an international celebrity. People would, the church at the time had installed, well, later in her honor, had installed a Tiffany window that's been destroyed by Hurricane Dora. But people used to come from all over the country to see that window and remember Harriet. And when she was living here, she was actually a snowbird, one of the original snowbirds. People would come from all over just to catch a glimpse of her on her front porch. I mean, she was a big deal.
Now, how can people be part of your new production,
which is a requiem to the millions that we've lost to the pandemic.
Yeah. Well, it'll be Sunday, November 6th, this Sunday, at 5:30 p.m. at the Episcopal Church of Our Savior. It's on Mandarin Road, 12236 Mandarin Road. Free of charge. All are welcome.
Well, come on out, folks. And composer Bob Moore, thank you so much for doing this work and letting us know about it, too.
I appreciate you. Thanks.
Well, tonight at our WJCT studios, we want to invite you to a special event. It's ADAPT, the State of the St. John's River, a panel discussion looking at the latest report out on the health of the waterway. We've got a preview right now with Lisa Reinemann of the St. John's Riverkeeper. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you in studio. Also joining us, Brendan Rivers, special projects producer with Jacksonville Today.
Good morning, Melissa.
Thanks for having this discussion, guys. All right. Lisa, let's begin with you. Last month, the Riverkeeper released your 15th annual State of the St. John's River report. And what did you find?
Well, you know, there is some good news. And one of the good news stories that we're celebrating is the reduction of nitrogen in the St. John's. But sadly, other pollution sources, as well as the impacts of climate change, are undermining some of the improvements with new threats to our river.
Such as?
Such as saltwater intrusion. We're continuing to see saltwater move further upstream, increased flooding risk, loss of wetlands and submerged grasses. Those provide flood control as well as they're the kidneys of the river, as well as an increase in phosphorus, which is the other type of nutrient that drives these toxic blue-green algae outbreaks that are continuing in the St. John's.
Not fun at all. Not good news at all. And only expected to get worse unless we take more action.
Absolutely. You know, we have to take collective action as well as individual action. We can all do our part to protect our St. John's and its tributaries as well as the River Springs.
Okay. So with all of that said, Brendan, tonight a special event in our studios. Tell us what's happening.
Yeah. So we are going to have two panel discussions. Lisa's going to be on one of those. And we are going to talk about the river report, some of the findings in it. And we are also going to talk a lot about individual and collective solutions. That's going to kind of be the focus this evening. And this year's river report, every year they have a highlight section. And this year's highlight section is specifically about climate change. So it's kind of perfect for us. So that's going to be the focus of this evening is climate change, what's causing it, how it's affecting the river, and what we can do as individuals, as businesses, as members of the community to help address the issues that are facing the river and us as a whole.
And let's talk about that, because a lot of people hear this discussion and think, well, what can I do? There are things you can do.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of things we can do. At its core, climate change is a systemic problem. We need to address it systemically. But the two things I always tell people to do as individuals, the most important things to do, are one, talk about climate change with people, because a lot of people just don't know the basics of it and that it's already affecting us now and affecting us locally. And also to vote for people who prioritize it, who accept the science of climate change and who make it a priority.
Of course, you report at our project, ADAPT. It's adaptflorida.org, adaptflorida.org. Where we do this, we talk about climate change, we report on climate change and how it is already impacting Florida and what we can expect to happen in the future. None of it good, by the way. So this is such an important discussion, Lisa. And, you know, along with you, there will be a lot of other really smart people coming tonight to share their thoughts and their expertise.
Oh, absolutely. I think the two panels are absolutely fabulous. Dr. Jerry Pinto will be on there. He actually is the head scientist on the river report. And so, as well as our new chief resilience officer, Ann Connellisi, will be on the panel, as well as other environmental groups on the second panel with Sierra Club representative Logan Cross, as well as Groundworks Jacks. And I just drew a blank on the third panel.
Jessica Tittle.
Absolutely. Jessica Tittle, who's new with the Florida Green Chamber, who's actually fantastic.
You know, whether it's the Green Chamber of Commerce, you at the Riverkeeper, or the fact that the city of Jacks now has a resiliency officer, Jacksonville is behind the times, but there is movement now in this city to address these problems.
Absolutely. There's movement, there's conversation, there's action, but we need much more swift action. And we also have to have a regional approach. We can't solve all of the issues with climate change or with the river, you know, all in a vacuum. So we have to work regionally.
Rick in Murray Hill is on the line. Hi, Rick. Good morning.
Hi. Hello.
Go ahead.
Hello. Hi. I wanted to say I recently attended a meeting of the Environmental Protection Board down in Jacksonville, and I was upset at the IFF odors at the moment. But in the process of watching how they work, I noticed that there may be an explanation as to why, despite everyone's efforts, the St. John's continues to get worse. They are taking people who dump thousands of gallons of effluent and wastewater openly, you know, into the river, and these people are being fined, you know, $2,300 after, you know, a 6-month hearing process and sworn never to do it again. Many of them were repeat violators. Apparently, every large project they were engaged in, there were violations that were treated equally lightly. It's not that I don't think, you know, people limiting their lawn use chemicals and these sort of things, getting rid of a septic tank. It's not that these things are ineffective or useless, but I don't think they're the source of the problem.
Okay. Thanks, Rick. What about that?
Well, I agree with the caller. We have to take individual action, but then this kind of falls in the category of collective action. And to Brendan's point about voting for people who care, because a lot of time Environmental Protection Board, Water Management District, the other agency, their hands are tied by laws as well as policies or fines that are kept too low that it's just the cost of doing business. And so having our elected officials, our policymakers, really putting protective rules that are meaningful to reduce pollution, as well as plan for climate change.
With all that said, come on out tonight. It's ADAPT, the State of the St. John's River, here at WJCT Studios, kicking off at 6 p.m. And I want to thank you, Lisa Reinemann, the St. John's Riverkeeper, and Brendan Rivers of Jax Today and ADAPT. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
You can register at wjct.org/events for this free event tonight. And come on out and see us. It's an important discussion, so come on by. A quick break, and up next, our ticket giveaway. This time, the fair is in the air. Funnel cakes, the Ferris wheel, and a whole lot more. We will drop in on the Jacksonville Fair right after this. Don't go away.
The Jacksonville Humane Society presents its 24th annual Toast to the Animals, Wednesday, November 9th at TIAA Bank Field, benefiting the Pet Medical Fund for homeless dogs and cats needing veterinary care and TLC. Hors d'oeuvres, wine, and beer. Tickets at jackshumane.org. St. Johns County Cultural Events presents Fort Mosé Jazz and Blues Series, February 10th to 19th, 2023. Live performances from artists like Gladys Knight, Mavis Staples, and Christone Kingfish Ingram. Tickets available Friday at discoverfortmosé.com.
I'm Robin Young. Journalist and poet Elsie Robinson wrote a nationally syndicated column for 40 years back in the early part of the last century. She was also a feminist pioneer.
She wanted women to have that voice far earlier than most of the champions that we so often point to.
Next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Hi, I'm Brendan Rivers, lead reporter for ADAPT from Jacksonville Today. This year's State of the River report says we should still be worried about the health of the St. Johns. So, what's being done to protect the river? And what can we as individuals do to help? Join me at WJCT Studios this Thursday evening to explore those questions with local officials, environmental advocates, and scientists. Head over to WJCT.org/events to register for free.
Right now, there's some of this.
I'm a Republican congressman saying nice things about a Democrat.
And a lot of that.
The safety net shredded. Drug dealers and sex traffickers roaming free. A third world country? No.
Both parties are on track to spend more on political ads than ever before. But who are they targeting and how? That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, guess what? The scent of funnel cakes will soon be in the air. The fair is in the air, that is, because the Greater Jacksonville Agricultural Fair opens tonight at the downtown fairgrounds next to TIAA Bank Field. Bill Olson is president and CEO of the fair, and he's here now in studio to tell us all about the fun. Hey, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you, and it's fun when the fair comes back to town. And our youngest saw the Ferris wheel last night, and she was so excited. What's on tap this year at the fair?
So we have a lot going on this year. Our musical acts, we're focusing on local talent this year. So we have a main stage with LPT tonight at 8 o'clock. Local band.
They're great. They're great.
And then we have a community stage too. So we have ongoing musical entertainment every day throughout the fair. And we do have two national acts coming in. Priscilla Block is tomorrow night, country artist. And then next week on the 10th is Connor Smith. We also have a bunch of, you know, acts we call shows, pig races and magic show and dog
show. Do you grease the pigs up before they?
They swim too.
They
do swim. You know, we have a Aussie Kingdom, which is Australian animals this year. Just a lot of things to do for your $10 adult admission. Gets you all of this for free.
Wow. And of course, we're talking funnel cakes, turkey legs, cotton candy. A fair isn't a fair if you're not eating something that's bad for you.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's all there is to it.
Fried Oreos, corn dogs, you know, all the good stuff.
So, you know, the history of the fair, Bill, in this town is a really rich one. And the downtown fairgrounds have been an institution for many years. But the fair will be moving at a certain point. Can you bring us up to date on what's going to happen?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the fair's been here since 1955. So a long time in this area. But we are moving to the west side next to the Equestrian Center. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a couple years to build it. So we're going to still be here this year and next year. The hope is 2024 to have the first fair out there, mm-hmm. but just depends on construction.
And there have been a number of reasons for that.
Yeah.
So, can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So down in the sports complex, the development that's happening, it's getting harder and harder for our folks that are coming to the fair to park and to mm-hmm. get to us. And so that's why the new fairgrounds is so exciting. It's going to be, you know, 80 acres from what we have now is about 20, right? Lots of parking. I think parking for 5,000 cars is what we're planning. So easy to get in, easy to get out, and enjoy the fair.
You're going to have a lot more elbow room. A
lot more elbow room.
Yeah. Are you excited about that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We can do all the things we talk about doing that we can't do now because of our restrictions with size.
What would you do differently once you get over to the west side?
More acts. We're planning on hopefully doing a historical village. So like a yesteryear type village, building that. We're building an amphitheater out there, so bigger concerts, as well as an indoor venue for shows too.
Nice.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, it's downtown. That's where the action is to come to the fair. And what time is it? Oh, let's do it right now. Folks, we've got a ticket giveaway. This is so cool. And perk your ears up because here's what we have. We have 1 4-pack of tickets to this year's Greater Jacksonville Agricultural Fair, which opens tonight downtown. Email us right now at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and just put fair in the subject line. If you want a 4-pack of tickets to the fair, we will pick one winner at random and you will be the hero in your household with the free tickets. Because Bill, even if you are buying the tickets, it's a pretty good deal. $10 a head to get into the fair.
Yeah, absolutely. For all the things we have planned, all the different shows and acts, and you can see the animals, and there's a, you know, 4-H does an animal encounter in the barns, and just a lot to do for $10 adults and $6 for kids.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned parking. You will be excited to get out to the west side with more parking. What parking directions do you have for folks who might want to come out tonight to opening night?
Sure. So tonight, parking is controlled by ASM, the city. So the parking garage is always a good place. Or any of the lots. Lot J by the stadium is another big one they can park in. So
yeah. So get in early, though, I would think, to get a good spot.
I would think. Yeah. We open at 5, so the earlier the better.
And it runs 11 days, so you've got some time to come enjoy the fair with your family. Again, email us firstcoastconnect@wjct.org to win a free 4-pack of tickets to this year's Jacksonville Agricultural Fair. President and CEO Bill Olson is here to give us the preview of all the fun. It's always great when we see the Ferris wheel and the other attractions go up downtown. And I have to say, I will miss it once it moves away, because it's fun to drive by and see it every year or go to it. But I wish you the best in the new location, and I'm sure that will be great, too.
All right. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Bill. And have fun, everybody, at the fair. You know, I have to say, my mom grew up on a farm, and she was in 4-H as a kid, and she would show animals at the fair in her little rural community when she was a kid. So, you know, those old traditions continue on today. So get out and have a good time. And thanks so much for listening. Thanks also to our team, David Luckin, Heather Schatz, Isabella Da Silva, our intern Gary Autry, and technical help from Morning Edition host Michelle Corum. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9. Thanks for the company, and make it a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.